Today's episode of The Wicked Library is an encore performance of episode number 302 with remastered audio and a brand new interview with KT Jane.
Hello, kiddies. Fall has fallen, and fall means the Wicked Library Halloween special is nearly here. It will be recorded live in front of a captive audience at Rickett and Beagle Books on October 17th from 7 to 9 p.m. and the show will air on October 31st, Halloween in other words. It's also going to be getting cold in our little village of the damned. So, in addition to the great prizes, tricks and treats, and other wicked fun, we're doing a little something we're calling blankets and books. Bring a clean used blanket to sit on for story time, and then leave the blanket before you're released. I mean before you go. Rickett and Beagle Books will be donating a book along with every blanket collected. And both items will be donated to the Hot Metal Bridge Faith community to distribute to the homeless. We hope you'll come by, but if you absolutely can't shamble down and still want to donate a blanket and maybe even a book of your own, drop me a line at librarian@thewickedlibrary.com and we'll get you more information. See you at Rickett and Beagle Books on the 17th, kiddies!
Mr. Librarian said I could say hello and tell you to come visit me at victoriaslift.com sometime. My building may be old and dark, but it's a lot of fun. There are 9 floors, and each one takes you to a very different place. I think you'll be surprised by just where my link can go. Most people can't find it, but you will. I'm waiting for you. I think you'll have a lot of fun here too. Unless you make the wrong choice.
The Wicked Library is brought to you by HorrorMade.com. From horror haikus to author and filmmaker interviews to original art and dark fiction reviews, HorrorMade.com has a terrifyingly fun collection of dark things that are sure to delight. Also brought to you by Shadows at the Door. Shadows at the Door is an ever-growing collection of haunted stories inspired by the ghastly, the ghoulish, and the macabre. You can enjoy the pleasing terrors and similar content at shadowsatthedoor.com. Also brought to you by Rickert and Beagle Books. Rickert and Beagle Books is a new, used, and rare bookstore located in Dormont, PA, specializing in science fiction, fantasy, horror, and weird nonfiction. Visit them on the web at rickertandbeaglebooks.com.
Warning. The Wicked Library contains adult themes, adult situations, adult language, and graphic depictions of terror, bloodshed, the occasional possession, and your future trips to your psychiatrist, so he or she can assure you it's only a story. This podcast is intended for mature audiences only. You've been warned, kiddies. Hello, kiddies. Have a seat and relax. I'm your librarian. There's nothing to be afraid of, yet. Hold on to yourselves, boys and ghouls. This is going to be a dark ride. We'll leave the lights on for now. No talking. It's story time at the Wicked Library. Push button, get bacon.
The sun was starting to go down toward the early part of the late afternoon, and I scanned the horizon looking for any breaks in the monotony of endless sand. Nothing. except the path of the train tracks I'd been following. Pulling the thick leather strap of my messenger bag over my head, I squatted, depositing it on the ground beside me. Flipping open the lid of my water bottle and taking a swig, I grimaced as the hot liquid rushed down my throat. One thing about the end of the world, I truly missed ice. I unfastened the two buckles on the front of the bag and peered inside. This was what was left of all my worldly possessions. A small velvet bag with a few pieces of my mother's jewelry, a small photo book, a baggie full of essential makeup, a hairbrush with hair ties wrapped around the handle, a plastic case of baby wipes, my tablet, a sketchbook, a few mechanical pencils and some pens, a Sharpie, a bottle of aspirin, a tube of sunblock, a small first aid kit, a flashlight, and some maps. I noticed that my fair skin was starting to have a slightly red glow, so I pulled out the sunblock and rubbed it in. I had been following this particular set of train tracks for 2 days, and I was hoping that I would find an actual town soon. So far, I had been through 2 stations, but the towns had long since disappeared into history. I knew I was close to a station. Tracks always lead to stations. I had passed a sign in the early morning that had proclaimed, "Garmin, 15 miles. So I figured I would reach it in a few more hours. I grabbed a well-worn map that had belonged to Caleb, my older brother. He was autistic and had a weird obsession with trains. He'd always collected train maps. He memorized train schedules and collected toy trains. I don't think he ever thought about anything but trains. That was before the sickness had gotten him and turned him into one of the walking dead. It had been 6 months since then, and these days, I was the one with the obsession for trains. I methodically followed him along tracks, hoping that there would be some trace of him left that maybe I could save. The few times I'd managed to catch up to him, there was only a few remnants left that told me that he'd been there. I always found his marks. So, I kept walking the tracks because I'd made up my mind that this is what Caleb's brain would lead his body to do when he couldn't cope with anything else. My eyes scanned the horizon once more, and this time I thought that there was a speck in the distance. Reaching up, I twisted the optics on my goggles, zooming in on the speck. It was a small building, possibly a station. I unfolded the map carefully and found that the mark I had made when I had last checked it, that was yesterday. I looked around for something to tell me where I was, but found nothing. This part of the tracks had veered gently away from the highway, and I hadn't seen a marker for a while. The last one had said 115. I found that point on my map and looked ahead. I decided it would be another 3 hours before I reached the speck. If it was a station, it should be Garmin. Caleb had bored our family to death with many stops at train stations over the years, but we'd never managed to make it to Garmin. I searched my brain for what Caleb had said about it, but all that I could come up with was that Garmin meant Gates of Hell, or something close to that. Caleb had a very strange sense of humor sometimes. Tenderly folding the map and returning it to my bag, I pulled my goggles off, reaching back to untangle the strap from the long red hair of my ponytail. The heat was stifling, and I felt as if I were melting from the inside out. Opening the plastic case with the baby wipes and prying it open, I plucked at a wipe and shook it. I swiped my face, feeling just a little refreshed from the wetness, even though it was warm. It was a silly piece of my old life, but a useful one. It was amazing what a small piece of civilization could do for you. I sat down flat on my bottom and stretched my legs out in front of me, twisting my ankles this way and that in my boots. I desperately wanted to take my boots off and walk in a cool stream, but that wasn't about to happen. Looking up at the sun, I saw that it had started its descent in the late afternoon. I took another drink and replaced my goggles. It was time to get back on the move. 2.5 hours later, I was about a mile from a small building that sat right next to the tracks. A faded sign clung in desperation to the side of the building. Adjusting my goggle optics once again, I could make out G-A-R in fancy stenciled letters. The station had been abandoned for some time, and only a handful of gray splotches clung to the wood, betraying that it had once been new. The station sat atop a hill, so it was difficult to discern if a town lay below it. I approached cautiously. The walking dead creatures sometimes congregated in places where they had gone in life. Just because the landscape appeared devoid of the monsters didn't mean they wouldn't pop out at the first opportunity. I saw no trace of movement at all, but I still felt unsettled. It was almost too quiet. I walked slowly toward the building. Reaching over my shoulder, I felt for the baseball bat that I had strapped there. The metal was hot against my palm, and I slid my fingers down until I felt the wrapped handle and grabbed it firmly. No Walking Dead freak was going to surprise me. I decided to circle around the station just to make sure that nothing unusual was hanging out there. The station sat squarely staring at me with the windows empty of glass. The light was slowly fading and the station was dark. There was still no hint of movement, but I could not shake the feeling that something was not right. I listened hard, but only heard the distant sound of buzzing flies. Rounding the corner of the station that was closest to the steps of the entrance, I heard a rustling sound. I pulled the baseball bat up and over my shoulder. I crouched at the corner and waited, listening. After a few minutes, I stood again, holding the bat out in front of me, readying it. After each step, I stopped, waiting, listening, watching, and then stepping again. This part of the station was elevated from the ground on stilts, and the space below was hidden by several pieces of lattice. There were a few places close to the ground where the lattice had broken through, just large enough for something small to pass. The rustling sound came again, and this time I looked through the lattice to see the shadow of movement underneath. A scrabbling sound carried out to me. The buzzing of the flies was louder here. Sliding my hand under the flap of my messenger bag, I felt around until I felt the plastic handle of my flashlight. I pulled it out and tested it. The LED light shone brightly through the dimness under the station. A few feet away, a cloud of insects hovered over the ground where I thought the scrabbling was coming from. A tangle of small branches jumped toward me with its fly escort. I kept the light trained on it as it moved forward. A bloody and ragged ear found its way past the miniature tumbleweed as Rabbit Paws kicked it out of the way. I saw the glazed eyes that were so typical of the human Walking Dead and jumped backwards, dropping my flashlight. I had seen some dogs and cats that had contracted the sickness, but never any other animals. I reached down to retrieve my light and quickly made my way up the steps that led to the main entrance of the station. Looking down and shining the flashlight over the edge, I saw that the little undead creature was disappearing back into the darkness that he had jumped out of. I turned my attention to the station itself. It was plain with only three windows on each side of the door. The door was wider than a house door, and the six small panes of glass that should have been in the window gaped emptily at me. Walking to the one of the windows, I looked inside. Shining my light inside, I saw no hint of movement or light. A sign opposite me welcomed me to Garmin. Moving back to the door, I reached out and put my hand on the knob. As I pushed the door in, it stuck a little, causing me to have to push it with all 110 pounds of me. The door was open just wide enough for me to slip in. Once again, I aimed the beam of my flashlight inside and did a quick sweep of the lobby of the station. There was some light coming in through the windows, and the light only served to illuminate what was in the corners, not touched by the natural lighting. It looked safe enough. I was beginning to think of sleeping here for the night. A few rows of chairs grouped together in threes or fours were bolted together and sat intermittently around the room. The ticket window grinned at me. There was still some glass intact in front of the counter, but as I stepped closer, I heard the flies buzzing again. I flipped the flashlight off and stood silently exactly where I was. Scrabble, scrabble came from behind the ticket counter. It sounded small, so I imagined it was another creature such as a raccoon or maybe even a cat. I approached the counter and used the flashlight to try and illuminate the area. As I inched closer, I noticed that there were bloody handprints and smears on what was left of the glass. Once again, I lifted the baseball bat in front of me. It was more for my own sense of safety at this point, but I knew I could swing it quickly and with some force if I needed to. The rustling, scrabbling sound came again. Crouching down, I made my way to the side of the counter and found a door. It was metal with one window mounted in the middle. I tried the handle and discovered it was locked. Using the end of the bat to poke at the remnants of glass, I then snaked my hand through the hole and turned the lock mounted on the knob. The door swung out toward me. Cautiously, I opened the door inch by inch until I thought that I could use the light to see inside. I was not prepared for what I saw. The small room was bathed in blood. Of course, it was dried up, but still the scent of iron filled my nostrils. In the corner of the room was a pile of what I thought was gray shop rags. I walked over to it and nudged it with my foot. The pile shifted, and an oblong object covered in blood and hair rolled next to my foot. Looking down with the flashlight, a skull grinned at me, with the remnants of a person still clinging to it. I jumped backward with a start and quickly turned to run out through the lobby. I swung the flashlight around until I saw a sign reading restrooms pointing down a hallway. My stomach was heaving and I pushed open the first door I came to. In the glow of my flashlight, I saw a sink, and dropping the bat on the floor, I grabbed it and vomited into it. After a few minutes of alternately vomiting and dry heaving, I leaned against the wall and picked my flashlight up off the floor. Looking around, I realized that I was in the men's room. Across from me was a urinal firmly bolted to the wall. On the floor below it was a pile of pieces and plumbing that I assumed could only be another urinal. Next to me was the metal bulk of an automatic hand dryer. I spun around so that I was facing it. Bringing up my flashlight, I examined the top of it. There it was. Caleb's mark. The familiar sticker was on top. The first part of the sticker showed a hand with a pointed finger pushing a button. Above it in black Sharpie and Caleb's cramped script was written, "Push button." The second half of the sticker showed the hands flat below three wavy red lines that were supposed to indicate heat. To the right of that, in Caleb's same cramped Sharpie was written, "Get bacon." I smiled to myself, imagining Caleb giggling maniacally while writing this. I reached into my messenger bag and used a wipe on my face, then took a swig of water to rinse the acrid taste of vomit from my mouth. I also found my sketchbook and opened it to a page with dates and times of when I had seen signs of Caleb. I had his old watch attached to the inside of my bag, and it provided me with the information that I needed to complete the current entry. Retrieving my bat and making my way back out to the lobby, blocks of orange came in through the many windows around the station, giving the illusion that it was completely on fire. Looking out the window confirmed that the sun was just setting. Against a far wall was a bench that I decided would serve well enough as a bed for a few hours. Next to the bench, in the corner, a vending machine stood. I went to it and looked inside. Rows of snacks stared back at me from behind intact glass. I found my bat, stood off to the side, closed my eyes, and swung hard. My arms tingled from the impact of the bat. Glass fell down into the machine and flew out toward the lobby. I grabbed a bag of chips and a candy bar and went to the bench to devour my prizes. Opening the bag of chips and reaching in, I shoveled some into my mouth and then sat down, looking at the room. I crunched thoughtfully. The ticket counter was to my right and the hallway leading to the restrooms to my left. The room was quiet, except for the soft buzzing of flies. I put my bag down next to me on the bench and pushed it against the wall at one end. Brushing my hands against each other and then wiping them on my jeans, I loosened the hoodie that was tied around my waist and wadded it up, finally putting it on top of the bag. That was as good a pillow as I got these days. I leaned back and got comfortable as I could. The last thing I did before closing my eyes was tuck the metal baseball bat under me, between my body and the bench. Then, I was immediately overtaken by exhaustion. I had strange and disconnected dreams in those hours. They started with memories of me and Caleb as children, and ended with him jumping on the train tracks. As my brain latched onto that metallic tapping that I was watching Caleb make with my bat on the tracks in the dream, I realized that the sound was actually happening. I kept my eyes closed and slowly inched my hand across my body until I touched the bat. I gripped it firmly and pulled it back over me. As my senses started to become alert again, I tried to pinpoint where that tapping was coming from. It seemed far away, and then again, it seemed to be right in the station with me. I waited and listened, realizing that not only was I hearing tapping, but another sound that I couldn't quite place. It was a dry, raspy sound. I slowly sat up, holding the bat on my lap and scooting forward so that my feet touched the wood floor of the station. I once again secretly said a thank you to the stars for the foresight I used when I chose my boots. They were black leather, but with rubber soles. I had thought hard about the sort of terrain that I might encounter on my journey to find Caleb, and these boots seemed like the most sensible choice. I was especially happy because my boots would make no noise on the floor. Standing up, I decided to return to the ticket counter. I stood on tiptoe and looked over the counter with my flashlight. The area still looked exactly the same as it had the previous day. A wash in blood and the only occupant, the pile of rags and the skull. I entered the little office once again and had a good look around. Nothing seemed to have moved in months, maybe years. There was nothing of use and there was no sounds coming from here. Turning around, I returned to the corridor that led to the bathrooms. As I made my way down the hall, the tapping increased in volume. I flattened myself against the wall and craned my head so that I could see into the bathroom where I had vomited the previous night. There wasn't much to see from that angle, so I tiptoed back into the lobby and pulled my compact out of the bag. Once again, I stood flattened against the wall, compact poised in front of me, pointing into the bathroom. This time I could see a shadow moving. I moved the mirror a little higher, hoping to see what was in there. I took a deep breath and closed the mirror. I turned my body so that I was facing the wall. Grabbing the doorframe, I cautiously poked my head around until I could see the urinals. The tapping was on my left, but I couldn't see without going completely into the little washroom. The tapping never ceased. It was monotonous and familiar. I stopped when this thought went across my brain. I listened closely, trying to tune into the raspy sound. The more I listened, the more I thought that the raspy sounds were actually words. Not just any words, either. The same words repeated over and over. Push button. Get bacon. I swallowed hard and held my breath for a moment. I listened again, shaking my head and trying to convince myself that I was not hearing those words. Several minutes passed, and still the words came with the tapping. Push button. Get bacon. I could stand it no longer. I stepped in front of the door of the bathroom and in the smallest, shakiest voice that I had ever heard come out of my mouth, I half whispered his name. Caleb? Everything stopped. I waited. The tapping resumed. The raspy words did too. I stepped into the bathroom and turned to look at the place where the tapping was emanating. A figure was standing in front of the hand dryer. It was hitting the button with its palm, and after each hit, repeated the words. I stepped behind the figure, close enough that I could have reached out and touched its back with my hand. I could not bring myself to do that, though. Instead, I just stood looking at the figure that seemed so familiar. Caleb? It turned and looked at me. I was overtaken with emotion when I realized that this was my brother standing in front of me. At least it reminded me of him. It took a step toward me and I instinctively took one backward in a sort of negative reaction. The figure stood in front of me and lifted one arm up, palm pointed toward the ceiling, in a gesture that seemed almost beckoning. I had to stop myself from fitting my hand into his, as I had done so many times over the years of my life. It's you, isn't it? I looked over him, trying to determine how far along in the sickness he was. I knew the signs. The first sign was the intense cramping in the intestinal area, which was followed by flu-like symptoms of intense vomiting and diarrhea. I had heard others describe sufferers as smelling like rotting meat. I sniffed. The bathroom was already fairly rank, and with the smell of old urine and vomit that I thought might even have been there when the room was brand new, I couldn't distinguish if Caleb's smell was the same or different. I suspected my own smell after days of following railroad tracks was not so pleasant. I watched him closely. He looked down at me, and I could see his deep, gold-flecked hazel eyes from behind the mass of dirty blonde curls. They seemed to be working to recognize me. I thought I saw a glimmer of recognition in there. "Caleb, I've been looking for you for a while. I thought I'd find you in a train station." I smiled.
"Garmin."
It was flat and raspy. Almost Caleb's natural voice, just deeper and drier. "That's right. This is Garmin."
"Gate."
I was trying to remember what was so special about Garmin. Now I remember that Garmin means gate to hell, doesn't it? I looked at him again. Even before the sickness, Caleb had been difficult to hold conversations with. He had trouble making eye contact, and he couldn't read body language well. He had immense difficulty trying to follow the normal rules of conversation, unless it was something he was interested in. Then he could go on for hours. I'd even walked away from him and come back to find him still talking, unaware that I'd gone. "Caleb, I need to know how sick you are."
"Sick."
"Have you been throwing up?"
"Sick."
This was going to be harder than I imagined. "Maybe we should go sit down." I turned and started to head back to the lobby. I looked over my shoulder to see him still standing in place. "Come on, Caleb." I returned to him and started to take his hand. Instead, I grasped what was left of his jacket and pulled him toward the door and the bench where I had slept just a little while ago. He shuffled slowly behind me. We arrived at the bench and I sat down, looking up at my sibling. As we'd gotten older, we had less in common. Caleb got more solitary and his interests narrowed so much that it seemed as if he only wanted to stay inside with his computer and research the things that he was interested in. He often told us that he loved his computer because all of his friends lived in there. He stood there rocking on his feet. I pulled my feet up so that I could hug my legs, and I watched him for a little while. "When we were kids, it always seemed like you were the younger brother, not the older one. It took me a long time to understand that you were the older sibling." He looked at me with the familiar blank stare that I had come to know was his way of processing his surroundings. "When we got older, it became easier to tell people that you were the younger one, just so they would understand and not think that you were retarded."
"Not stupid."
"No, you're not stupid at all. That's the hardest part for people to understand. You're not stupid. Information just gets in and out of your brain differently than other people's."
"Autistic."
"People don't understand autism."
"Hard."
I looked at him again and smiled. It was hard. For everyone. "I was mad at you when we were growing up. Mom and Dad always made me take care of you. I always had to watch out for you. That made me get picked on sometimes."
"Mad."
Yeah, mad. You would get stuck on stuff and couldn't let it go for anything.
Stuck.
It suddenly all sounded very silly. Caleb was all that was left of my family. My parents had both succumbed to the Walking Dead sickness and died. Caleb had started walking before then. We had actually forgotten about him in all the confusion. I looked at my older brother and felt tenderly toward him. There was no longer any distance between us. We were just two people with a common past trying to figure out how to put it back together. Except that my brother was not really alive. He wasn't dead either, unless you ask the flies. I noticed that the flies were drawn to him. They crawled over him without disruption. He didn't attempt to swat them away at all. This was not the Caleb I knew. He was so sensitive that flies crawling over him was almost painful. Today, there was no recognition of this pain, either real or imagined at all. I wondered how this felt for his oversensitive nature. Does it hurt, Caleb?
No. Hurt.
I shook my head, not really knowing what to think. I knew it was only a matter of time until the sickness disabled all his logical thinking patterns and he became a mindless brain seeker and eater. I wondered for the millionth time if this was the fate of all humankind.
Better.
This was the first time he had said something that wasn't in reply to something I had said. It took me by surprise. What?
Better.
Better than what?
No. Hurts.
It's better than not hurting? I shook my head in frustration, trying to understand what he was saying.
Better.
Caleb, I don't know what you're saying. This isn't better than anything.
No. Hurts.
He was starting to look frustrated, so I just nodded and smiled. He stepped toward me, and again his hand came out to me and touched my hair. I looked up to him and found that there were tears running down my face. I don't think you have very much longer until you're completely changed, Caleb.
No time.
I know. I'm sorry. I should have spent more time with you when we had it. I wish we had it now. We should have spent our time more wisely.
Okay.
I know. It is okay. Should I be doing something for you? I was formulating images in my brain where I was going to have to hit my brother in the head with a baseball bat, and I just wasn't sure that I had the heart for it.
No hurt now. Better.
I sat and watched him for a very long time. My mother's words were swimming around in my brain, and I was trying to imagine how this might be better for Caleb. When I was little, Mom used to tell me that you were special because you were super sensitive to everything in our world. She told me you were so sensitive that people looking at you hurt. That smells and lights and sounds could hurt you without meaning to because of your sensitivity.
Sensitive.
I stopped and wiped my eyes because now that I was thinking about growing up with Caleb and how my parents had to work to make it seem okay, I was really missing them. I guess it was good that Mom and Dad made it feel so normal that you wore headphones and hung out naked in your room and only ate the same six things that I didn't realize until I went to friends' houses and saw their brothers didn't act like that. It seemed normal until then. Suddenly, I knew that something was very different about you. That was scary.
Different.
So, I guess I just want to know that you aren't hurting.
No hurt. No sensitive. Better.
Okay. I wanted to sit here like this with him for a while, but was worried that the violent change would come quickly and he would forget that I was his sister. He seemed suddenly aware of my quandary. I know, I'm going. I love you, Caleb. I always have. I just was sad that you weren't the kind of big brother that I could look up to and admire. You were so different than the other big brothers. I wanted a normal big brother, and I got you. So, I'm sorry I wasn't a better sister because of that.
Good sister.
I stood up and turned my back to him, pretending to be very interested in my messenger bag while I decided where I might go. There was no reason to go back the way that I came. There was no reason to go on.
Others.
What?
Others. Okay.
I thought this over for a moment and decided that Caleb had seen others. Where? He shuffled to the window and looked out, pointing in the distance. I turned and followed him, looking past him. I saw that in the distance at the bottom of the valley were some houses.
Gorman.
That's a town. Are there other survivors there?
Others. Okay.
All right, I'm going. Are you coming with me?
Go alone.
Are you scared?
No. Scared.
I nodded. I wanted to hug him, but suddenly I did smell that rotting smell that I knew the flies were attracted to. I went back to the bench and pulled the strap of my bag over my head. I stood for a moment taking a mental inventory and noticed that my bat was missing. I looked around and found it on the floor next to the bench. Reaching down, I picked it up and examined it. It was the same as always. I lifted it over my shoulder and found the loop on my bag that actually held it into place. I'm going down to Carmen, Caleb. You go the opposite way in case they aren't friendly. Stick to the tracks, and I'll maybe find you again one day. I went to the station door and opened it by pulling on the handle hard. I walked out into the sunlight and blinked at the brightness. Looking back, I saw my brother standing behind the window. I thought for a moment that he had a slight smile on his face. He hadn't done this much before he got ill, though, so I decided it was really more in my head than anything he'd actually done. Walking down the steps to the sand below, I turned once more and gave a little wave that I knew would not be returned. I was thinking about my brother during my walk to the town. I finally decided that he was probably not hurting at all anymore. He must be feeling like he is in heaven. He was no longer so oversensitized that he had to worry about all the sensory input. It was suddenly gone. I was starting to think that maybe Caleb was actually exactly where he should be in his life. Or is that his not life?
Stay tuned for a short Q&A with the author in just a moment. If you enjoyed today's episode, tune in again next week for a great new Wicked Tale by Owl Going Back. Today's episode featured a story by KT Jane, Push Button, Get Bacon. If you'd like more information on KT and her work, please visit her on her website and follow her on Twitter at Auti Zombie Girl, and check the show notes for spelling on the website and the Twitter address. You'll also find her Amazon book page there and her Facebook page. Big thanks to Miracle Austin for a great story last week, and to Jeanette Andromeda for the kick-ass art. Don't forget to visit our sponsors, Shadows at the Door, Rickert and Beagle Books, HorrorMade.com, and SanitariumMagazine.com. Please share the terror. Share the show. Help us grow. The best support you can give us is to rate us in iTunes. Ratings are free, and they mean a lot to us. Follow us on Twitter at Wicked Library. Find us on Facebook and subscribe to the show in iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google. We're everywhere. Don't forget to sign up for our newsletter to get great prizes, bonus content, and more. You can sign up at thewickedlibrary.com. And now, KT Jane. So, my guest today is KT Jane, and we just heard your fantastic story, Push Button, Get Bacon.
Yes.
It's from season 3 of The Wicked Library. It deals with the whole concept of zombies in a whole new way that I've never seen before.
That's what I like to hear.
Yeah. It's hard to do something fresh with zombies. There's been tons of stuff done with zombies, you know?
That's a story that is the nearest and closest and dearest to my heart. It was the first story that I had published, and it was the first story that I ever had done on a podcast. Mm-hmm. So that story's been a lot of first for me, but I always liked the idea of looking at things and, you know, what's a better quality of life for people and how do we look at what the quality of life for anybody is.
Right.
And that's what I like about that story is that it really does look at, you know, what's the best quality of life for the brother here and who gets to decide that for him.
Yeah. No, it's a really good story for that reason. It's one of the main reasons why I wanted to put it back in there, because I think it's an important topic, too, for people to kind of understand a little more. And I know that that's one of the reasons that it's a very personal story for you. Did you want to talk a little bit about why it's such a personal story for you?
It is a personal story for me because I am on the autism spectrum. I have Asperger's. My son has Asperger's. And kind of dealing with those attitudes towards people on the spectrum. And, of course, you know, I always hear, well, you don't look like you're autistic, which I'm not sure if I should have, like, a big letter A on my forehead or, you know, how I should address that with people. But, you know, it is very near and dear to me because I grapple with those issues of living on the spectrum every day and how I associate with other people. And now that my son is a young adult and is learning to deal with the world on that level, which at the time that I wrote the story, he was a teenager. And the brother character in that is kind of loosely based on my son. So I like looking at those attitudes of other people and kind of changing their attitudes, because I really think a lot of people think that people on the spectrum just we rock and roll in the corner. And yeah, I have my moments, but that's not the way that it always works out. And I like kind of affronting those attitudes and just kind of introducing that other side of people on the spectrum. There's a whole high functioning side of the spectrum.
Right, right. Well, a lot of people probably think Rain Man when they think of autism, and that's just one aspect of it. And
it really is.
It's nice that you have an opportunity through story to kind of deal with that and talk a little bit about it. And that's one of the things that I've always loved about story and storytelling is that it gives us kind of a safe place where we can talk about these topics, because the pressure is kind of off whenever it's fiction. It changes the way people look at things, I think.
And I do have to say one particular thing that I've always loved about the way that the story was done on the podcast was, you know, I've heard that story, read that story myself a million times. But when I heard that story the first time, it went up early on a Friday morning, and I woke my husband up and said, my podcast is on. And so we sat and we listened to it, and here I am. He's still half asleep. I'm perched on the edge of the bed, getting ready to go to work, listening to this story. Yeah. And I'm bawling my eyes out, which to me is amazing when you can make me do that with my own story that I've read 100,000 times. And it's an amazing feeling. And if you can make me do that with my own story, then, hey, I'm all in.
Right, right.
And so when readers do go to find out more about me as an author and things, mm-hmm. one of the things that they will inevitably run across is my my WordPress page, mm-hmm. which is called Land of the Not Quite Right. One of the things that I do a lot on that page is talk about different things that come up in my life and how I deal with them coming from that perspective, that autistic perspective, because, of course, I don't always think of things the way that neurotypical people do.
Right.
And I'm not trapped in a box.
So tell me a little bit about your writing process and how you use your Asperger's to your benefit whenever you're working.
With my process, the Asperger's is a benefit and a boon kind of at the same time. There's a certain amount of kind of OCD sort of perfectionism that comes with Asperger's.
Right.
And that can really, it gets in the way of long projects a lot of times, which is explains why it's taken me 7 years to get my zombie novel anywhere close to where I think that it might be ready to send out the door. Mm-hmm. And I know if I open it up again and it's going to be another year.
Right.
So there are times that that perfectionism that comes with that is a problem. Mm-hmm. But then there are times when it's a really great thing because I do see that the universe in general in kind of a skewed way. And like you said, you know, I don't think anybody ever wrote a zombie from an autistic point of view before.
Right.
I'd never seen it. And one thing that I did with that story that now I kind of wish that I hadn't done so much of was kind of relied on some of those stereotypical things. I actually don't know any autistic people in my universe that are so completely obsessed with trains, although I know a lot of autistic people are. Mm-hmm. Now when I look back at that story, I kind of go, should I have relied on that kind of system so much? But I realize that in a way that it's a good system because that is something that people associate and can pick up on and go, oh yeah, I know that about autism, that some people really, really like trains.
Yeah.
And even if that's the only thing they know, then I can use that as a kind of a springboard to move onward.
Absolutely. It kind of becomes a sort of shorthand to get them to the table and
exactly
have them comfortable at the table so you can tell them the rest of the story. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, because another thing that really works well to my advantage with the Asperger's is because my senses are so overly stimulated so easily. Mm-hmm. That when I write things, I rely on those things. When I write and you read, it's you smell it, you see it, you touch it, you feel it, which is really hard for a lot of writers to do. Mm-hmm. And it kind of goes back to, and I never really understood it when I was a kid. You know, you'd hear your English teacher say, "Show me, don't tell me." Mm-hmm. And I absolutely hate that phrase, but now that I have gotten a few things out there and I've had people react back to me and people react back to me on my blog and tell me, oh my gosh, when I read that part about your son, I cried my eyes out and I'm like, oh, what did I write about? And I'll have to go back and look, and then I'll be like, oh, yeah. And then I remember how it felt, and I was crying when I wrote it on the blog. Mm-hmm. And somehow that translates for people. And I think it's just that ability to kind of take what I experience as being overstimulated and being able to put it on paper, for most people, It's, oh yeah, I get that. Oh, I can smell that. Oh yeah, I can see what that would feel like. Oh, I remember when I touched something that felt like that, or mm-hmm. I remember when somebody hit that button in my brain and it made me really upset and made me cry. And yeah. And I think that I translate that a lot better sometimes than other people, because I take that overstimulation that I have and kind of lay it out.
Right. And, no, I see what you're saying. That makes a lot of
sense.
And
that works, you yeah. know, it works for people.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you often incorporate spectrum characters into your work?
You know, I see, because like my science fiction story, the character there was not autistic at all, but he was a guy who built smart houses.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess some people could kind of interpret that as autistic in a way. but no, not always. But the main character in the zombie novel that I'm working on is a boy with Asperger's.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like that we're kind of an underserved population in that aspect. One thing that I know very definitely from working with a lot of kids on the spectrum, and especially on the high functioning end, is that they have no role models out there.
Right. That's why I was curious if you made a conscious effort to incorporate characters like that.
I don't make a conscious effort to do it, but I think that since that's my viewpoint,
mm-hmm.
that it just kind of happens organically sometimes.
Right. No, I get it. You mentioned that the autistic or the Asperger, the spectrum characters are not often represented in writing, and therefore, you know, folks to look up to and for kids to identify with. What advice would you have for a writer that would want to incorporate a spectrum character into a story in such a way that they're not doing a disservice or buying into stereotypes? Because I think that sometimes becomes the fear that writers have. You don't want to trivialize it. So knowing that you work closely with a lot of autistic kids and you know, you're on the spectrum yourself, what advice would you have for a writer that wants to incorporate a character with that wants to portray them in a positive way?
Well, as an autistic person, my first instinct is to say, don't do it. But because it is so easy to fall into those stereotypical things. And one thing I think that everybody who's on the spectrum or works with people on the spectrum will tell you is that when you've met an autistic person, you've met one autistic person. And so, you know, my first instinct is to say, oh, God, don't touch that, please, because it can so easily go wrong so quickly. But I think that the biggest part of it is that there's a way to get that feeling across of what we experience, you know, in a meltdown situation or in an overwhelmed situation. There's a way to do that and not do it badly. And I think you just have to observe a lot of different people and talk to a lot of different people, talk to a lot of different moms that go through that, you know, I guess depending on what you're going to write about with that. And, you know, and I think the way that they do the BBC Sherlock is absolutely brilliant, because even though I know people are kind of tired of his, you know, the way he puts things together, it's such a great representation of how my brain works. So when I look at Sherlock, he is that one really good role model on TV for me to see, because it's like, yes, I know how he put that together. Oh my gosh, yes. That was freaking brilliant. Oh my God.
You know? Awesome. So what projects do you have coming out, or what are you working on now that folks can check out and visit your website to find out more information about?
I did the Fear Project at the beginning of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And took what I thought was going to be a short hiatus, just to kind of refocus, regather my thoughts, work on a few other creative outlets, because of course for some reason I can't just do one creative thing. I have to have 16,000 creative things going on.
Yeah, I have that problem too.
I've been working on something especially for you this weekend.
Awesome.
I'm just trying to you know, I'm going through that. What was the exact right word for that? Yeah, that one. So that's kind of where I'm at. And it's kind of an interesting little story. And I was like, what am I going to do with this little story? Because it was just kind of like throwing those words onto the paper because I needed to get them out of my brain. And
yeah,
when I got about a quarter of the way into it, I was like, this is what I'm sending to Wicked Library.
Awesome. Well, we always appreciate a second story from our authors. I mean, it's you've already built a following at that point, so people will be looking for the new story. Where can folks find your work online? Where can they go to interact with you and find your work?
So you'll have links to the Facebook page, which is KT Jane.
Mm-hmm.
And if people want to look up the blog and see what the misadventures of an autistic zombie girl look like, they can go to WordPress, and it's Autie Zombie Girl, AUTIE, as an autistic, and Zombie Girl. Mm-hmm. And find my words of wisdom, not so wisdom, and probably quite a few curse words, so I caution.
Anyone who's made it this far into this episode already knows that this is for adults.
And yet I've managed to not use my favorite vocabulary word at all. I'm very proud of myself.
Nah, well, fuck.
I know, right? And anybody who knows me will tell you that I can use that word as any part of the English language, and I am very comfortable with it.
That's right.
So if you're not comfortable with that word, please stay away from my blog. But yeah, if you're really interested to see how many incarnations it can take. But yeah, the WordPress site and the Facebook page are the best way to kind of find out what I'm working on and what's going on. People can still go to the Fear Project and read the stories that were up for the Fear Project.
Okay.
And I'm not sure I attacked any autistic characters during the Fear Project, but I did attack quite a few of my own fears,
mm-hmm.
which is always good, I guess, as a horror writer. If you're not afraid of anything, you can't write being afraid, right?
Well, that's correct. You write what you know. What scares you, right?
Right, exactly.
Well, I do want to thank you again for taking so much time to talk to me, and also for letting us run your story again. It was a lot of fun to do it a second time, and I hope that listeners will go and check out your website and pick up the work that you have out there. You're in a few anthologies, I believe, as well.
I am. I'm in two anthologies that are out. There's a new one getting ready to come out. It's called 44 Lies by 22 Authors. And there's one story in there that actually was a Wicked Library story, one of the Santa Claus stories that mm-hmm. I did for a Christmas episode. And the second story is a cautionary tale about a preschool teacher. Uh-huh. and it's a cautionary tale about what happens if you leave your children at daycare too long.
Awesome.
So, and that one's called They Taste Better with Ketchup.
Nice. Sounds wicked.
Sometime this year, hopefully.
Excellent.
And also people can go back and pick up back issues of Jamais Vu, which was put out by Postmortem Press last year. I have two nonfiction articles in there, which are really interesting reads. So
awesome. Well, again, thank you. I hope the listeners enjoy hearing the story, and I know that they'll enjoy hearing your unique insight on the story and writing in general, and hopefully we'll have another story from you again real soon.
Yes. I'm getting back to work.
Awesome. All works read in this audio recording and associated music and artwork are copyright of their respective creators and may not be used in any form without their permission. Dramatic reading performed by Nelson W. Piles. You all remember him. The voice of the librarian was performed by Nelson W. Piles. The voice of Victoria Bigglesworth Hayes was performed by Amber Collins. The Wicked Library theme was written by Anthony Rousek and performed by Novus. All other music in this episode was performed by Kevin McLeod of Incompetech.com and used with his permission. The Wicked Library is a Ninth Story Studios production. Producer, Daniel Foytek. That's me. Producer, Daniel Foytek. Executive producer and creator, Nelson W. Piles. Full show notes with links and artwork can be found at www.thewickedlibrary.com/BS3-1. Until next time, this has been Daniel Foytek. Go ahead. Leave the lights on.
It makes it easier for you to get the bacon.
Music, talk, stories, politics. This is the Society 13 Podcast Network. Kettle Whistle Radio. Music, the Wicked Library, stories. Mouthing off. Progress. Politics. GBA with Mr. Pink. Talk. The Ninth Story. Music. Red Horse Radio. Politics. Society 13. Where bad... I can't say that. Where Naughty Donkeys listen to podcasts.
Society 13. Where Naughty Donkeys...